This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy Monday. Beautiful day here in Portland, Oregon. You know, if you like cloudy. At least it's not raining right now. Oh, boy. Our president is melting down. The continuing revelations from Mr. Wolf's, Michael Wolf's book are, shall we say, causing consternation in the White House. And, you know, appropriately so. I mean, there's some serious stuff being charged there. But it raises a pardon? That is never discussed in the media. And that is the idea of monarchy in the United States. I mean, we talked last week about how Donald Trump apparently believes that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama committed crimes to get to the White House and in the White House. And for that matter, apparently believes that Jack Kennedy did the same thing. And he believes that Bobby Kennedy and what would it have been, Loretta Lynch for Barack Obama, and who was Bill Clinton's head of the DOJ, he had a couple of them. But in any case, that, you know, apparently believes that these DOJ officials, these attorneys general, we're all there basically to protect the president rather than defend the Constitution, which is the oath that all federal officers take. So I wrote a piece this weekend that's up over at Alternet right now. It's titled Tom Hartman, Time to Overthrow Our Rulers at alternet.org. And it's been picked up by a few other websites around the internet if you see it someplace else, which is just fine. And I start out by pointing to an article that Leslie Wayne wrote in the New York Times on, I think it was published on Saturday, it might have been Friday. And it was an article about how countries like ours should have, according to the International Monarchist League, should have a royal family. And the reason, the argument that they make, and this is quoting from her article, countries with monarchies are better off because royal families act as a unifying force and a powerful symbol. Monarchies rise above politics, and nations with royalty are generally richer and more stable. Now, I would submit to you that that exact same argument is the rationalization that very wealthy, politically active people in the United States use to justify their wealth, to justify using their wealth to change the political dialogue in this country. I think that there's a difference between people on the left and people on the right, wealthy people on the left and wealthy people on the right who are doing this. I believe, my experience has been, that the wealthy people on the left are simply trying to restore American democracy, to get us back to a country that works on behalf of all of us, that is, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, of, by, and for we the people. Whereas the oligarchs on the right, the very wealthy people on the right, are explicitly living out this neo-Calvinistic dream or fantasy or whatever you want to call it, that an economic monarchy is a good thing because wealthy people can rise above politics and be a unifying force for the nation, that wealthy people being in business can generate wealth, and that's a good thing, and that makes the country richer. And having an aristocracy like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett is just a fine, fine thing for America. I beg to disagree. I point out in the article, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Donald Trump actually believes that Obama and Clinton and apparently JFK committed crimes while in office. Now, what I didn't get to when I earlier mentioned that was, why does he believe this? He apparently believes this because a billionaire oligarch who left Australia for the United Kingdom and then bought a bunch of the media in England, in Great Britain, and flipped it hard right, and in the process flipped much of the politics in the UK hard right, then came to the United States and bought the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and created Fox so-called News, and has flipped the politics of the United States hard right. And Fox so-called News apparently is where Donald Trump got this conviction, this belief, that Obama committed crimes, that Clinton committed crimes, that JFK committed crimes, real serious high crimes and misdemeanors, things, you know, treason-like things. And therefore, he should be able to, too. There's also the issue of the corruption of our politics by the morbidly rich. So badly that a small group of billionaires have funneled so much money into our political sphere that so-called normal Republicans like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, now they're both very toxic. They both want to destroy Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But that's a normal Republican, at least in today's era, that normal Republicans are saying, hey, we couldn't get past a primary challenge. And the reason why, of course, is because the billionaires will fund the primary challengers. I mean, you know, your average right-wing nut job doesn't become an effective average right-wing nut job unless he's got a billionaire backer. This, you know, this was writ large back years ago. We had Peter DeFazio on this program, I think 6-8 years ago. He represents part of Oregon. There is an ex-high school chemistry teacher here in Oregon by the name of Art Robinson. And you can Google this. It's very humorous. Art Robinson believed, I assume he still does, that radiation is good for you. And so the solution to the radioactive waste problem in the United States is to turn it into home insulation. It generates a little bit of heat, plus, you know, maybe it insulates, I don't know. And that way we are all exposed to continuous low levels of radiation, which will make us somehow magically, what, immune to the bomb? I don't know. Everybody in Oregon, not everybody, most people in Oregon thought of Art Robinson as a crackpot. But he nearly beat Peter DeFazio the first time around. Why? Because a New York hedge fund billionaire, the Peter DeFazio angered, threw all this money at Art Robinson. And it's not, I mean, you know, that's just like one example. That's happening all over the country continuously. This is why Jimmy Carter on this program said, America is no longer a democracy. We are now an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery. The former president of the United States. And nobody in our media, even on the so-called corporate left media, you know, the MSNBCs and whatnot, is willing to discuss the impact of petro-billionaires. I mean, they'll point out that Republicans deny climate change, but they never say that Republicans deny climate change because they want to continue getting money from the Koch network or from other petro-billionaires, from the coal industry, from ExxonMobil. They never point out it has to do with money. There's no other reason that the Republicans would deny actual science. I mean, it's not like these Republicans are total Luddites. They actually do believe in science. When they get sick, they'll take antibiotics from their doctor. But, you know, hey, big money. And now we got Ryan Zinke and Scott Pruitt, the guys that the billionaire toady Mike Pence put in at Interior and EPA, dismantling our country as we speak. This is the impact of the morbidly rich on America, our aristocracy. In my opinion, it's time to overthrow that aristocracy, and we have a template for doing it from 1932.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Franklin Roosevelt called these people out, named them, he called them economic royalists, and went after them mercilessly. We must again. And welcome back. George in Chicago. Hey, George, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, I wanted to Well, one of the things I think is the funniest thing that I came up with was like Tweedledee, Tweedledum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As a joke on how Trump tweets?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a name that will make him feel small, because Tweedledee, Tweedledum puts you in a real bad spot.
Yeah.
Cornering thing.
Although
he uses words on other people.
Yeah, although, George, you know, Michael Wolff says that everybody describes him as a 7-year-old, as a child. Tweedledee and Tweedledum are from, as I recall, a fairy tale for 7-year-olds. Maybe Trump will like it.
There it is. Yes. And the other thing, I called you about 3 weeks or more ago, and I had a outlook that I gave that I think it might have made you uncomfortable at that time, but now I think it might make more sense. It's like Trump and Putin and Bibi Netanyahu are similar characters. I mean, they have a force about how they run things and how they attack people and how they put people in spots. Now, what happened with the Palestinians is similar to what happened in Russia with his neighbors. And then it's like Trump just want to do anything to have that type power to put over Chicago, where I'm at. They will bring in, you know, the army to do the police work, because he wants that kind of power. And he has his other, the little gangs around him, but that is, I think, the major heads of this three-headed beast that's coming up.
George, I think you've identified something really important, and there's kind of two pieces to this. One is that Trump seems to be enamored of, and maybe even is choosing as role models, authoritarian leaders around the world, whether it's Putin or Netanyahu, whether it's Modi in India, whether it's Duterte in the Philippines, Salman in Saudi Arabia. All of these guys are authoritarians on a spectrum, you know, as is Trump. So you've got that. And then at the same time, speaking of Israel, Israel has now said that if you are a supporter of the BDS movement, the boycott, divest, and sanction movement against Israel, then you can't visit the country. They will stop you at the airport.
True. So that's that same mindset that I think the three of them carry. And I was like putting together, because this is a scam that's going on, that I don't know if they're conscious of it or that it's their plan, that this scam is like this game, three-card Monty,
yeah.
That when one tells, it's really, I'm trying to form this game that's called lie. So you tell a lie, and then you do, you know, a sleight of hand when you land down the card.
Yeah.
And say, okay, you're going to look for...
I think the bigger issue, George, is that Israel essentially is saying right now, if you disagree with us, we're going to keep you out of the country. We don't need no stinking free speech here. And I think that that's a huge mistake for Israel. George, thank you for the call. Well said. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the breathtaking speed with which the entire movement of the right wing machine that was created in 1971 when Lewis Powell wrote a memo to Eugene Sindor, his neighbor and friend who ran the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He laid out the Powell memo. There's a bunch of information about that in my article today, in my alternate article today, Time to Overthrow Our Rulers. And by our rulers, I'm talking about the morbidly rich. Franklin Roosevelt, in 1936, he said, You know, it's natural and perhaps human that the privileged princes of these new economic dynasties, thirsting for power, reached out for control over government itself. Now, tell me that's not what Adelson and Koch and Mercer are doing? They created, says Franklin Roosevelt, a new despotism and wrapped it in the robes of legal sanction. In its service, new mercenaries sought to regiment the people, their labor, and their property. And as a result, the average man once more confronts the problem that faced the Minuteman. This is the sitting president of the United States. 4 years into his term, saying that the right wing is coming after him and that we need to revolt against them. He said, these economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power, said the President of the United States. In vain, he said, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. In their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, they stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection, and against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the American people massively agreed with Franklin Roosevelt. So much so, the Republicans lost control of the House of Representatives in the 1932 election. They had it for 2 years, 47-48, out of the 1946 election. But that was it. From then until the middle of Bill Clinton's presidency in the mid-1990s, I think it was the election of 96, it might have been 94, but from, it might have even been 90, well, it would have been 92, it might have been 94 or 96, but literally from 1932 until the 1990s, 60 years, with the exception of that one little two-year period when they passed Taft-Hartley, during that entire period of time, the Republicans did not control the U.S. House of Representatives. Why? Because the American people knew what the Republicans were all about. That they served the interests of the rich, that they wanted to destroy Social Security, they wanted to destroy Medicare, they wanted to destroy Medicaid. They worked against the interests of small and medium-sized businesses. They wanted to flatten wages for working people so that more money could flow to the top. And they started doing all this in 1980. We're now 37 years here, 36 years, post-Reagan Revolution. And it should be obvious to everybody, 36 years of flat wages, declining wages, actually, for the bottom, you know, for people making under 50 grand a year, for the bottom half of America, or maybe under 40 grand a year, whatever that number is. This is, you know, where we're at, to the point that Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president, 4 years into his term, 1956, writes a letter to his brother Edgar, who's a right-wing wackadoodle, and says, you know, because his brother was saying, hey, you're not being right-wing enough. And he says, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, or eliminate labor laws, you would not hear that party again in our political history. There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are H.L. Hunt, a few other Texas oil millionaires, and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, wrote the President of the United States, Republican Dwight Eisenhower. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. End of quote from the letter from Dwight Eisenhower to his brother Edgar. Big business knew this too. Prior to the 1980s, big business did not involve itself in politics in the United States. I mean, it certainly did in the 1920s. Supporting Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, Herbert Hoover. But after the great crash of 32, when Americans who were alive then, and most of them are dead now, but the Americans who were alive then got it, figured out that this big business-run nation did not work, that handing America over to big business was a huge mistake. And big business figured this out. And from 1932 until the 1980s, business, yeah, they lobbied, but, you know, not that big a deal. The federal debt wasn't that great. It wasn't even, it was under $1 billion until Ronald Reagan became president. Excuse me, under $1 trillion until Reagan became president. And then in 1971, Lewis Powell wrote his memo. 72, Richard Nixon puts him on the Supreme Court. 76, he helps encourage the court to rule in the Buckley versus Vallejo case that when billionaires own politicians by funding their political careers, think Shelley Adelson, Marco Rubio, Robert and Rebecca Mercer, Donald Trump, the whole list of them, that when wealthy companies and individuals own politicians, said the Supreme Court in 1976, that's just fine. We had made it illegal in 72, 73 as a result of the Nixon scandals, but the Supreme Court in 76 knocked down those laws and said it's just fine for billionaires to own their very own favorite pet politician. And here we are.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It was the fulfillment of the Powell memo. We'll be back with your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I wanted to share with you a few clips from Franklin Roosevelt. And then we'll pick up your phone calls here. But the question that is constantly being asked, particularly in the talking heads on television, is what do the Democrats have to do to regain political power? Right? What does it take? What it takes, my friends, is something very, very simple. Donald Trump showed this during the Republican primary and during the election when Trump came out and he said, "Those banksters, they're killers." Right? They're robbing you blind. He said he was going to do away with carried interest. Of course, he didn't. He didn't do anything about the banksters. In fact, he wants to further deregulate the banksters. But he talked about it. He said the things that got him elected. Now, the difference is Democrats actually believe this stuff and actually will legislate based on this. So you want to know, Democrats, what to do to get elected, to get and hold power? Listen to the guy who was elected president of the United States 4 times. The only person in history to be elected president of the United States 4 times in a row, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is 1 week before the election of 1936. He's running for re-election. 1 week before the election, and FDR is saying this about how he took on the rich.
"We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs.
As they do now.
And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob."
Government by organized money, a major danger to America. And then Franklin Roosevelt talks about, you know, what he did about this and how it was
responded
to.
"Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred."
And I welcome their hatred. And can you fade down the applause a little bit? Thank you. You can hear, I mean, it just goes on and on and on, this applause for Franklin Roosevelt. It just doesn't stop. I mean, this is like, you know, a full, 40 seconds or so. In fact, I've clipped up part of it off. And then it comes back. They're still cheering him. Yeah. And then he says, "I took on the rich people on your behalf. And in my first administration and in my next administration, I'm really going to do it. Here he is.
I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it, the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said, wait a minute, I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it, these forces met their master.
Met their master. And they did. You know, he had passed Social Security, he had passed the National Labor Relations Act. I mean, just massive changes to the American economy and the American landscape that made, you know, really, you know, a functional modern democracy possible. It's remarkable. So Democrats, if you want to know how to win, right? You want to know how to win an election. Talk like this. Here's FDR again. Just talk like this.
Recognition of that falsity of material wealth as the standard of success goes hand in hand with the abandonment of the false belief that public office and high political positions are to be valued only by the standards of pride of place and personal profits. And there must be an end to a conduct in banking and in business which too often has given to a sacred trust the likeness of callous and selfish wrongdoing.
There you go. I mean, you know, how is that not our banksters today? And then his warning, his gentle warning to Americans. And this is so brilliant. Let me warn you about these Republicans.
Let me warn you and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course, we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Tell me this is not, I mean, that was like 1934. Tell me that today the Republicans aren't playing the same scam they were in the 1920s and the 1930s. It's amazing. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that actually, you know, I absolutely agree with you about FDR. But the thing about FDR that is different from this new class of people is that he really was hated by his class, and he didn't really care for him all that much himself. He had a terrible experiences in the elite schools that he went to, and you know, I think that reflects both in him and Eleanor, who also had a very similar experience. And so, you know, it's just, I think it's the person, and we, you know, need to realize that we are all, you know, we will all have the capacity, you know, to have what they call noblesse oblige. And you're absolutely right. Calvinism absolutely destroys that because it's pervasive. It's through the entire culture. And that is what is used as the ideological base for all of this, is to say, well, you know, we need this person who is redeemed. All of us are just living in total sin. This is absolutely wrong. And it was condemned when the, you know, back when the Israelites asked for a king. God said, no, you shouldn't, you know, have a king. And I think that our founding fathers realized how morally bankrupt it is to have an aristocratic class. You can read the histories of these people, and it's a horror. It's an absolute horror because they never had to earn anything. They never had to really really do anything. They don't know what it's like to suffer. They have, they just don't get it. But I think that FDR got it, along with other people at that time of his class. But, you know, we don't have an aristocracy, and we don't need one. We were, a shining light in the whole world to bring an end to the divine right of kings and church and state. And here we are back again. We have a people in this country that believe that we should have an official church. They want to make this a theocracy. And they don't even understand what that means. Frankly, if they want to do all of it, they should send them over to England. You know, Philip and Elizabeth can give him, different kinds of cues as to how to conduct himself in public, how to do all of that. But frankly, I'd like to, we fought a revolution already once. So let's just move on from it. But it is, I changed what I said. I'm sorry, but you hit a chord. It's really interesting, and I don't know why people trust. They don't trust each other. They trust this strong man, and he's pathetic. I mean, that's what's really ironic, is that they created a total fantasy. Well, nothing real about this.
But that's my point, John, is that the rubes, the Fox News watchers, they believe Trump because of this multi-billion dollar right-wing media infrastructure, like the enemies of FDR from 33 to 36 anyway. Were animated by Father Coughlin, who,
The difference is today, they have so much more control. We had a more democratic media. We had more voices to counter that at that period of time. And I think that people were different, too. They could see through that. I think that they're so brainwashed. Brainwashing is very successful. Just look at what happened in China, what happened in Russia, what happened in Nazi Germany. Brainwashing is very successful, unfortunately. And a lot of people get it that what is happening, what the real problem is, but they're locked out because now they're so entrenched in power, and we need to fight them all the way. Our whole life really depends, and the life of our children depend on, just getting rid of this whole,
oligarchy.
Regime. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We have an oligarchy, and it was brought to us courtesy of the Supreme Court. It's just very, very simple and very straightforward. John, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Sean, we're in our break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Coming up on 15 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back with more of your calls. And welcome back. Jared in Downington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jared, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Just a correction. You're wrong about the political control of Congress. The Republicans controlled the House of Representatives and the Senate from 1953 to 1955. After the election of President Dwight D. Eisenhower in a landslide election where he won most of the country outside of the really solid South, running on a platform against communism, corruption, and the Korean War. And
okay.
So,
I'll have to look it up, Jared, but, you're generally a fairly reliable information source. If I'm wrong, I stand corrected.
Anytime. And the reason the Democrats controlled the House is because of gerrymandering, which is why we currently have the current batch of Republicans, although that could change the census year. Anyway, I want to get to Korea. Mm-hmm. I'm increasingly concerned about this bipartisan, if you will, that there's a bipartisan push to attack North Korea. And I'm deadly, deadly afraid of this.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, I don't know if I ever told you this, my grandfather fought in North Korea. And let me tell you something. It's a war we forget for a reason, because it was hell on earth.
Yeah. An uncle of mine fought there, too, and came back, threw away his medals and said, don't ever mention that war to me, and went to his grave without ever mentioning North Korea or Korea again. Those soldiers saw hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My grandfather only mentioned war with me one time, and this was a couple weeks before his death. Mm. And he only talked about the Pacific War. He didn't talk about Korea, per se. But from what I've heard my mother tell me, he would wake up in the night screaming and just other things that I don't want to talk to you on air about. Do people realize that the reason Korea has nukes is because we wiped out 30% of their population?
And we virtually leveled every building in the country.
Yes.
I mean, Pyongyang looked like Hiroshima.
Exactly. And we used bioweapons there, too, which nobody talks about. We were thinking about using nuclear weapons.
What bioweapons did we use in Korea?
What?
What bioweapons did we use in Korea?
I don't know, but I remember one time hearing we did use some bioweapons, and it did affect some of our troops there as well. But I can't remember what kind of bioweapons. It was probably early form of Agent Orange, an early form of it, I guess, or something like that.
Mm.
Can't remember exactly.
Okay.
But I think here's what I would do if I was president. I would end all the sanctions on Korea. I would establish an embassy in North Korea. And generally, I would remove all U.S. troops from South Korea. Because the only way we're going to have peace is by ending this, you know,
standoff.
Something, your war with Korea.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you, Jared. I'm not totally convinced about pulling the American base, but downscaling it considerably and letting South Korea take responsibility for their own safety seems like a good idea. Welcome back. We're talking about the state of our nation right now. Mary in Lyle, is it Lyle, Illinois? Am I saying that right, Mary?
Yes, Lyle.
So what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about something that I think would have been news in another administration that's not news now, that I found on federalnewsradio.com. It's a website for government employees.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that the Treasury Department is taking the extraordinary measures of borrowing from the Thrift Savings Plan G Fund for the next 2 months to help them from defaulting on their debts. Their currently borrowing limit is reached at $20.5 trillion.
Right.
And so they're borrowing from the government employees G fund in order to keep from.
Yeah, this is happening. This is happening, Mary.
Pardon?
This is happening in multiple agencies. And it's because although the conventional wisdom or the story that's put forward by the media is that the government's going to run out of money on the 19th. The reality is that we ran off budget sometime back, and mm-hmm. so there's been a lot of moving money around to keep from shutting the government down. But we're way past the end of the last appropriation.
Yeah, they say they won't actually start paying it back until March or April. And I was wondering, with all the tax cuts and everything like that, I mean, what are the chances of them actually being able to pay it back? And have you ever heard of an administration doing this before?
I think given that what you're talking about here is the Treasury Department, the odds are fairly high that money will be paid back. Yes, during the last two government shutdowns and one event that didn't lead to a shutdown, but it came damn close, where we ended, you know, where we passed the point where the government was out of money, but they were able to move money around and keep paying bills. Mm-hmm. In every one of those cases, the various agencies, whether it was Interior, remember they shut down the national parks for a while,
yeah,
the last government shutdown, whether it was Interior, whether it was Treasury, you know, any of these agencies that are doing the stuff that, you know, government needs to do, got their funding back. The big question in my mind is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, are they going to get their funding? We're going to be talking to Alex Lawson a little later on the program, and he's pointing out that the Republicans are calling for a multi-$100 million cut in the Social Security Administration's staffing, which means that, you know, a couple of years ago, say 5 years ago, if you applied for Social Security, it might have taken you a half hour. Now it might take you all day because, you know, they don't have as many people, and so it takes a lot longer to process applications and things. And that's all designed to make people angry with Social Security and angry with government bureaucracies so that they will go along with the idea of turning Social Security and its $2.5 trillion trust fund over to Jamie Dimon or whoever the CEO of Wells Fargo is these days. That's what's going on. But Mary, the money will be refunded. What I'm concerned about is not the money that's going to government agencies that are doing, quote, critical functions, but rather the money that's going to humans. You know, average individual. You got chip funding, right? Nine million children. That has run out in several states now. I mean, the funding itself expired several months ago. And Congress has not put that back into place. So there's a number of real critical things that impact the lives of ordinary working people that that may well end up, you know, bad. I'm not so concerned about the Treasury Department. Mary, I got to move along, but thank you for the calls. Excellent question. Lance in Kaito. How do you say that, Lance?
Yes, Keith Kotz movie.
Okay.
I'm not from around this area. I wasn't raised around this area, but there's a way of saying it in the Hopi way. But yeah, it's pronounced Kikotsmovi. So
okay.
That's how I pronounce
Kikotsmovi.
It. But anyways, Tom, thank you for all that you're doing and for all your awareness on the Native American history. I just wanted to make it a brief introduction there to myself. Thank you for all you do. Also, Nancy Pelosi, you remember after Harvey, after everything was starting to be assessed, it was going inland, it was dissipating, and Nancy Pelosi and a few other Democrats got on CNN and they were doing their announcement, and when they asked her about a few questions, she was up there, I think you remember this, she was up there and they asked her, hey, something about the climate or the effects of it, and she said something to the effect of, well, there are some people that think that, you know, climate change may have been a factor. And it's like, you know, right then and there, we don't need a leadership like that. We need another Democrat that's going to lead this party that would have been someone like you to have been in that situation in that point in time to say, yes, this, in fact, points directly to climate change. And we need to enforce that with the Republicans.
Yeah,
you know, someone to have been right there at that point in time for all those millions of people to hear that and see that, you know, that would have been a lot better.
Well, that was my whole point, Lance. That was my whole point of playing FDR, is that Democrats, you know, Nancy Pelosi was trying to be not just politically correct, but scientifically correct. You can't, you know, just like back, you know, pre-1999, people would say, well, you can't say that that man's cancer or that woman's cancer came specifically from those cigarettes, because the cancer doesn't have a little sign on it that says I came from a lucky strike. So, you know, and that's how the tobacco industry, warded off lawsuits for years and years. But your point and my point is that Democrats, and Lance, thank you for the call, is that Democrats need to get plain spoken. They need to get blunt. They need to do what Donald Trump did in the primary. Speak simply, speak in bumper stickers, and don't be afraid of hyperbole. Don't be afraid of it being highly emphatic. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.